From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How you doing, Ann?
Hey, happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
What'd you do?
I had a nice day. Got to see my dad.
Oh,
my whole family went to a wedding over the weekend. One of my cousins got married in the great state of New Jersey.
Oh, fantastic.
And we all stayed over Sunday morning, had a great brunch. I saw my dad, hung out with my kids. It was a good day. How about you?
Great. Yeah, we were at the beach. We had a fantastic time with my parents, and I got my husband and son, I probably shouldn't say this on the podcast, matching periodic table t-shirts.
Come on.
Serious.
You're trying to out-nerd everyone?
Case closed.
Wow.
Game over. Yep. Mm-hmm.
We have some other nerdy stuff.
We have a lot to talk about.
We have a lot of nerdy stuff to talk about, which I guess we should get to. There was this sort of nutty interview released over days that Donald Trump did with George Stephanopoulos. We have some stuff about Flynn and his new lawyer, Kellyanne Conway being accused of violating the Hatch Act. And we have a new back and forth between the Department of Justice with respect to subpoenas issued by the House Ways and Means Committee. So first, the Stephanopoulos interview.
Yes.
The totality of which was aired last night. Can I say a couple of non-substantive things first about this interview?
Yes, please.
So I'm watching it yesterday, and the first thing I noticed, I know this is maybe a frivolous point, but they're sitting, George Stephanopoulos and the president, in the back of the limo, the presidential limo, which is called the Beast. And the first thing I notice is that the water they have in the Beast is Aquafina.
Aquafina. Pepsi water?
I guess. Product placement?
Yeah.
It was very jarring to me.
It's just like The Apprentice.
Right.
A product placement, yes.
The second thing I noticed, which I didn't tweet about because I thought maybe the frivolity of my tweets was not welcome by all, but in the first scene in the back of the Beast in the presidential limo.
Why do they call it the Beast?
I don't know. I don't know why it's called the Beast, but apparently it has all sorts of crazy powers. It can fly. It's also a submarine. It can go to Mars, of which the moon is a part. But in the first scene in the back of the limo, the president of the United States is not wearing a seatbelt.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And George Stephanopoulos is wearing his seatbelt, and you can see the shoulder strap. And then in the second scene in the back of the limo, neither one of them is wearing a seatbelt. Do you think that was like a...
And the car is driving.
And the car was driving.
Yeah, it's really bad.
Should we get to the substance of those interviews?
Yeah, but you know, it is really bad. You're the president of the United States. It's the law to wear a seatbelt in the front everywhere. And in many states, it's also the law to wear a seatbelt in the back of the car. And not to pull out the law on you, Preet, but he should wear it. Teach you when you have kids, everybody in the car is to wear a seatbelt because one person not wearing it is a tremendous threat to everyone in the car. I sound like the National Transportation Safety Board, but...
Are you saying the president of the United States is not a good role model for kids?
I am on this particular question, yeah. And also, why were they even taping in the Beast? I don't know. It's kind of like Bill Barr with the fireplace behind him. I don't.
Well, they taped a lot of places. They were walking around. They were in the Rose Garden. There were lots of places. I thought George did a good job.
He did. He asked a lot of follow-up questions, and we should talk about the president basically saying in the Stephanopoulos interviews that there's nothing wrong, basically saying what's wrong with listening to damaging information from a foreign country, a foreign opponent, from a political opponent. So the conversation starts with Don Jr. And Stephanopoulos is pushing Trump on this question of whether Don Jr. should have gone to the FBI when he first got the email from, you remember, the Russian lawyer before they set up the meeting in Trump Tower in the summer of 2016. The response from Don Jr. is, if it's what you say it is, I love it. It was purported to have dirt on Hillary Clinton. And so what Stephanopoulos asks is, quote, should he have gone to the FBI when he got that email? And Trump pushes back and says, okay, let's put yourself in a position. You're a congressman. Somebody comes up and says, hey, I have information on your opponent. Do you call the FBI? I don't think. And Stephanopoulos interrupts there and says, if it's coming from Russia, you do. So he jumps in and Trump comes back. I'll tell you what, I've seen a lot of things over my life. I don't think in my whole life I've ever called the FBI in my whole life. You don't call the FBI. You throw somebody out of your office. You do whatever you do. And Stephanopoulos, again, and this is one reason why I thought he was good, he didn't let it go. He said, Al Gore got a stolen briefing book. He called the FBI. Trump makes this distinction, Preet, that I wanted to talk with you about. He says, well, that's different, a stolen briefing book. This isn't a stolen. This is something that said, we have information on your opponent. Oh, let me call the FBI. Give me a break. I can't even do it sarcastic.
Well, no, he does it in that sort of low, hostile growl, saying, let me teach you a lesson about life, mister.
Can we just stop here, though? Because he's making this whole distinction, and we heard it in a number of ways last week, which is that this is opposition research. This is basically dirt on your opponent. But it actually is stolen.
The example that was being given before, I mean, the problem is with the hypothetical, right? And so Trump is able to say something that is, you know, pretty outrageous. And then because he's so vague and unclear in his own language, in his own response, and because it was a hypothetical, he has some ability to walk it back because it depends on what the hypothetical is. But the thing that we've been dealing with in 2016, and the thing you're concerned about is you're exactly right, is stolen emails.
It's not opposition research. It's information that was stolen. It was two things. It was information that was stolen from the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign, and it was misinformation that was intentionally driven to social media sites. And so there are crimes that people have been charged with that form the basis of that information. Now, I'm not saying that Don Jr. or anyone knew at that time, but you have a foreign adversary. You have people from another country, which, number one, is a campaign finance violation to accept anything of value, which we'll talk about in a minute. But number two, it does turn out this is actually stolen information. This is a crime related to a crime of computer hacking. It's crimes related to social media. And so he creates a hypothetical that has the facts he wants it to have. And he's trying to make this distinction. And he says, opposition research, opposition research. This is not opposition research.
The thing about this interview, and it goes on, you know, past what you just quoted from, is the way that Trump answers the question, you know, that's the thing that is really in his mind. And there's always the walk back later when there's an overwhelming amount of criticism, including from Republicans in this case. But you know when he does that low growl thing, and it's in the moment when he's asked an open-ended question, not actually a particularly tough question, that he's saying what he really thinks. Trump goes on, he says, let me call the FBI, give me a break. Life doesn't work that way.
Oh, let me call the FBI, give me a break. Life doesn't work that way.
The FBI director says that's what should happen.
The FBI director is wrong.
Mm-hmm. That's what he thinks.
Unbelievable, because the FBI director, and look, we can disagree with the FBI director. I mean, the United States of America, we can disagree with anyone we want. But here, the FBI director, the person responsible, the highest law enforcement official responsible for enforcing, investigating violations of United States federal law, has said, what you need to do is call us. And the president of the United States says, no, don't call.
Well, he then says, and this is the basis for his walk back later, because when Donald Trump sort of throws up a lot of different words in his various word salads, there's always something he can point to later to say, well, he hedged a little bit. So when Stephanopoulos says, your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, meaning adversaries, if someone else offers you information on opponents, should they accept it or should they call the FBI? And Trump says, I think maybe you do both. Maybe.
Right.
He doesn't say you definitely do both. Maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, and then he makes up his favorite.
I know. Why?
Norway.
Why Norway?
I was in Norway. It was very lovely.
I was feeling badly for the Norwegians.
From Norway. Do they often provide oppo research
Not that I know of.
Anyway, he says, from Norway, they call and say, we have information on your opponent. Trump says, oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
Well, first of all, they're totally different questions. Of course you'd want to hear. I mean, Trump, of course, he'd always want to hear it. And let's be honest, a lot of people in the world would be like, oh, you have dirt on my opponent? What is it? That's not the question here. The question is, how do you respond? Does it violate U.S. law? And what's the right thing to do?
But then he goes on again, right?
I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI if I thought there was something wrong. But when somebody comes up with oppo research, right, they come up with oppo research. Oh, let's call the FBI. The FBI doesn't have enough agents to take care of it. But you go and talk honestly to congressmen. They all do it. They always have. And that's the way it is. It's called oppo research.
It's called oppo research. Again, what he's doing is completely confusing two separate things, which is, look, it's as old as time that people in America try to get dirt on their political opponents and use that dirt in political campaigns. As long as you don't violate a law, that's fine. But if you violate a law, let's say you break into a campaign headquarters, for example, that's a crime and you're not allowed to do it. So it matters how you are getting dirt on your opponent and who you are getting it from. The fact that people want it or have used it is completely irrelevant to this question.
Yeah, and look, maybe we should focus on what the crime is. There is a distinction between things that come domestically and things that come from abroad. And why is that? Because from the beginning of the country, from the founding of the Republic, people have been worried in America about influence from abroad. Maybe that's a little bit less of a concern, you know, as 200 and some odd years have gone by. But at the founding of the Republic, that was an incredibly serious concern. So what does the law say? The law says essentially, it shall be unlawful for a foreign national, directly or indirectly, to make a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value.
To a political campaign.
To a political campaign, federal, state, or local election. Yep. So that's explicit in the law, something that is clear as day. The only thing that is subject to, I think, interpretation is what is a thing of value. So in all of these circumstances, just so people are clear on it, if some foreign official, and not even foreign official, some foreign citizen offers to Donald Trump or his campaign or any other campaign for that matter, $10,000, that's clearly a violation of law. You can't take that money
clearly
if you know
value.
It's coming
yes.
from a foreign country.
Yep.
You cannot do that. That's very clear. The question is, if they're offering something else that's not cash money, is it a thing of value? And there's a lot of law to suggest that certain kinds of information, damaging information, could in fact be a thing of value. And in any event, that's something for law enforcement to determine, not each individual campaign.
And it's an important part of the law. And the law says a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value. So it's expected that there could be contributions that go beyond just traditional financial contributions. Why? Because otherwise, when it comes to things, any type of political corruption cases, you have this conversation because people often swap things that aren't money. And so if you didn't capture that, you'd have a problem. One thing we should focus on just for a second is that Mueller addressed some of this in volume one of his report on pages 186 through 87. Quote, a threshold legal question is whether providing to a campaign documents and information of the type involved here would constitute a prohibited campaign contribution. The foreign contribution ban is not limited to contributions of money. It expressly prohibits a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value, and it cites the statute. And the term contribution is defined throughout the campaign finance laws to include any gift, subscription, loan, advance, or deposit of money or anything of value. The phrases thing of value and anything of value are broad and inclusive enough to encompass at least some forms of valuable information. Throughout the United States Code, these phrases serve as terms of art that are construed broadly. It also makes sense to me that this is a thing of value because people pay for opposition research. People pay to have access to information about their opponents. And so to say that it wasn't a thing of value when campaigns hire people to go out and get that information, there are people, opposition research folks that were working for both campaigns. So to say that this kind of information, again, I don't count this as opposition research per se, but it's information about your opponent. To me, there's no question that it has to be something of value.
What's extraordinary also about the president's statement, and I think his honest reaction to George Stephanopoulos' very basic open-ended question, is that he has learned nothing. You know, even if you think there's a way to weasel out of the hypothetical, given what we've just gone through with what he calls a hoax and a witch hunt, this whole business about Russian interference in our election, which I think has been established beyond all reasonable doubt, whether anyone conspired with him, Mueller said we didn't have sufficient evidence. But the fact of the interference is there. And for his reaction to be like, you know, you don't call the FBI, there's nothing wrong with any of this, given that this has been the whole fiasco we've been dealing with, is really, really extraordinary. And it also signifies something else. One of the reasons given why there was no charge with respect to conspiracy, in part, and not everyone liked this, was some suggestion that Don Jr. and others were kind of naive
right.
and didn't understand really what the law was and what you're supposed to do and whether or not they had the right level of intent. Well, now everybody knows. Now everybody understands what the law is. And not to put too fine a point on it, but there was another extraordinary statement made in the last few days, this one from the chair of the Federal Election Commission, Ellen Weintraub, who puts out a statement. I think on Twitter she said, it's amazing that I still have to say this, not to get too repetitive with respect to the law. But she puts out a statement, which I haven't seen anything like this before, which begins, quote, let me make something 100% clear to the American public and anyone running for public office, and then restates what you and I have been talking about, how it's illegal to take something of value from a foreign national. And then she says, this is not a novel concept. Electoral intervention from foreign governments has been considered unacceptable since the beginnings of our nation. And then she goes on to say, our founding fathers sounded the alarm about, quote, foreign interference, intrigue, and influence, closed quote. And then finally, she says, any political campaign that receives an offer of a prohibited donation from a foreign source should report that offer to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And then, by the way, who else said that, as we've already referred to? Chris Wray of the FBI, the Federal Election Commission, Bob Mueller, Chris Wray, any reasonable person understands that if you're getting an offer of assistance from a foreign national, it doesn't even have to be an intelligence service, but a foreign national, you don't accept it and you call the FBI. And the fact that Donald Trump still can't say that forthrightly means that we have maybe some trouble ahead of us.
I agree with you completely. It's the most stunning part of this entire conversation and what he said last week is that not only does he not get it, he thinks it's wrong. He really feels that he should be entitled, I think, to get access to this information. And this one is not a close call. This is one of those things where it is a question of the rule of law and it is a question of the safety and security of the United States. Most people in our country would fight and die for the right to be a democracy and to choose our presidents, but it is our choice. It is not the choice of foreign governments or foreign nationals as to who we elect. It's such a fundamental thing for our government and for the president of the United States to be saying what many national security folks said last week, which is the president has essentially told Russia and China, come on, hack our elections again. Do what you need to do. Like, you know,
it's an open invitation.
It's
an invitation now.
We're open for business. We're open for wheeling and dealing. And just so people understand, the problem with that is that you get in a position where there's a quid, where foreign governments are providing information or manipulating our elections. You're changing who becomes president of the United States. And you have a president who's beholden to a foreign government.
By the way, this has come up before, not just with George Stephanopoulos and the president, but the May 1 Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, Senator Chris Coons of Delaware asks Bill Barr, the Attorney General, a great question. He says,
Going forward, what if a foreign adversary, let's now say North Korea, offers a presidential candidate dirt on a competitor in 2020? Do you agree with me the campaign should immediately contact the FBI?
That Barr pauses because he's a little bit smarter than Donald Trump. And he realizes it's a loaded question. Where Trump just answered from the gut to Stephanopoulos, Barr pauses. And Coons, rather than allow the pause to turn into an answer, narrows his question a little bit, providing Barr with an out. So Barr says, foreign intelligence service. Coons then says,
if a foreign intelligence service, a representative of a foreign government says, we have dirt on your opponent, should they say, I love it, let's meet, or should they contact the FBI?
If a foreign intelligence service does, yes.
Barr reformulates the question to answer it narrowly by saying, if a foreign intelligence service does, yes. So that's another example of Barr being a bit more clever and a bit more sophisticated.
By narrowing it so deeply.
Yes, than the president, but sort of carrying the water of the president's view.
Completely carrying the water.
That some of this stuff is not so bad. It's not so bad. And I think the problem starts with the president, but it doesn't end with him.
It also
continues to the attorney general, too.
It's also contrary to the law. One of the things I want to note is that we saw last week that a number of Democrats are talking about introducing legislation now to say you can't do this. And so the Anti-Collusion Act, also the ACA, just like the healthcare bill, they need to find a new name. But the Anti-Collusion Act was introduced last Wednesday, would require everyone running for federal, state, or local office to report offers of assistance from a foreign government or agent of a foreign government to the Department of Justice. But you know what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is exactly what Barr just did. And the Democrats have bought into that as what's against the law. That's not the case. It's against the law for a foreign national. That means somebody who is from another country. It doesn't mean a foreign government. It doesn't mean a foreign intelligence agency. Sure, those are also prohibited, but they're narrowing it, and everyone is narrowing it so much in a way that is just not consistent with the law. Nobody from a foreign government, from a foreign country, can interfere in a U.S. election, period. And nobody else can, and no one also can steal things, whether you're from the United States or abroad.
So I don't think we need to review. I think we're very clear what the law is and what's going to happen going forward. And we'll keep our eye. Yeah.
One more thing on the interview, the Don McGahn piece. What did you make of Donald Trump's statement about Don McGahn essentially saying that he's lying about being instructed by the president?
It makes no sense. It's very clear that Donald Trump was trying to get rid of Bob Mueller. He relies again on the vagueness of his language before to make a different excuse later when it comes under criticism and under scrutiny. Everybody in the universe who has a thinking brain in their head understands that Donald Trump was trying to get rid of Bob Mueller and that Don McGahn, who otherwise had every reason to protect the president and serve the president, there was a line he wouldn't cross. And Trump's assessment that, you know, why would he do this? Why would McGahn do this? Well, maybe he wanted to look like he was a smart lawyer. There's lots of ways to look like a smart lawyer. He was trying to look not like a criminal.
Yep.
So moving on. So John Durham, the U.S. attorney in Connecticut, who has been assigned by Bill Barr the task of looking at the origins of the counterespionage investigation involving Russia. You know, a little bit of news with respect to him.
So Durham has indicated that he wants to speak with CIA officials, and specifically with the officials who were involved in determining that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, intended with the election hacking and the interference in the election, the intent was to help Trump win and not just to create chaos in the election and in the United States. And of course, this is something we know the president is obsessed with, whether or not any activity influenced the election. He wants to believe that he won the election completely without any involvement or interference. What is important about this? And I sort of think we should pause on this for a minute, because I've been watching this and every time I see a story about this, I get a pit in my stomach. And so I just want to sound the alarm, which is that I think we are on a direct collision course here, which is that what Bill Barr will do is come out with a report attacking the FBI, the CIA, essentially buying into Donald Trump's theory that the whole thing was a witch hunt, that the investigation was not properly done, undercutting the entire Mueller and Russia investigation, and doing so in ways that are deeply, deeply problematic. You know, I'd love to hear your take on it, but this probe, I think, I could tell you where it's going to end, and that makes me very nervous. And I'm not saying that Durham is political. I'm just saying that Bill Barr clearly has a goal in mind. And what we're already seeing is this idea that you're going to question the CIA. And again, everyone deserves to be held to account, but this is different. And in my view, it feels much more political than we would want it to be. Get the 9/11 Commission. Literally, if they went out today and got the exact same people who were constituted on the 9/11 Commission to do a review of this entire Russia and the response of the U.S. government, okay, that's fine. Have that conversation. But we've seen that Robert Mueller has done a series of indictments and gave, I believe, a very persuasive argument and case for why and how the Russian government interfered with the election. And so to suggest that starting an investigation into that was not legitimate... What do you think, Preet? You may not be quite as alarmist as I am on this, which I would welcome, by the way, because it concerns me.
Yeah, you know, so I don't know. Hope springs eternal, but you said something interesting a second ago, and that is, you know, you have some trust in John Durham. I do also, based on his reputation. I don't really know him personally, but he's had a lot of challenging, tough assignments that are politically sensitive and then involve the highest levels of government. He's done it before, and he's done a good job, and I think he's gotten praise from both sides of the aisle. However, I also had faith and trust in Bob Mueller. That doesn't stop, it appears, Bill Barr from putting his own gloss on the work done by other people who are pretty neutral about these things.
And isn't it actually smart if he's trying to get to a certain end? He picks someone who will be seen generally
Durham puts together, you know, some information, a report, compiles something, and maybe that doesn't even get released, but Bill Barr puts out, you know, principal conclusions.
A four-page summary.
It's not a summary. That is much more dire in how it characterizes. You know, as we've learned on the show and you learn in America, you know, characterization of things.
Framing.
And rhetoric about things in some ways can be as important as the thing itself.
Yes.
And sometimes more important, especially if people don't read the underlying thing, either because it's too long and they don't have time, 448 pages of the Mueller report, or because it's secret or classified. And then you can proceed by innuendo and brazen rhetoric. And so I don't know. I think we'll have to wait and see. I'm concerned that it's a cynical exercise, like you describe, but I don't know.
I may be a little more cynical today. I just think it is very possible that Durham is just a pawn in somebody else's chess match. And that would be Donald Trump's chess game with Bill Barr sitting right at his side. Let's go a little more upbeat.
I don't know that he plays chess.
Well, you know what I'm saying? So here's the other question. Is there anything that anyone can do? I don't think so. I mean, this investigation, Durham's investigation, is ongoing. The president has given Barr authority to declassify information. It seems weird for Congress to hold hearings into an investigation. I feel a little bit like we're just watching a train wreck happening, and right. It's sort of slow motion.
Kind of a rerun.
Yes.
You know, there's some things you can do after the fact. And if there's a new administration, and then the next administration raises the curtain and says, well, we're going to release more information. And look, there's a cost to every time there's a concern about an investigation. Releasing confidential information, sometimes declassifying information with respect to that investigation. And you just go round and round, you know, circle after circle after circle. But well, I guess we'll have to see. Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, whose story never seems to end.
Yes.
Keep thinking, okay, we're kind of done with that guy. He's been charged. He's pled guilty. He's going to be sentenced. In the middle of that sentencing some months ago, everyone will recall, the judge didn't seem too sympathetic to him when the defense lawyer tried to make Michael Flynn sound like a victim, even though he had pled guilty under oath and conceded that he had committed a crime, and he knowingly did that.
And had committed other crimes beyond which he had not pleaded guilty to. You almost got me to say pled, Preet.
It is pled. so they asked for an adjournment of the sentencing. which the judge granted. And now, as we were nearing the new sentencing date, Michael Flynn fired his lawyers at the esteemed firm of Covington & Burling and hired a new attorney, Sidney Powell, who I don't know.
I don't know her either.
But you know, you do some reading on her. I guess the strategy and the tactic of dealing with the case seems to have taken an abrupt shift, because Sidney Powell is someone who was a former federal prosecutor many, many years back, in the 80s, I believe, for a period of time, and is a very, very vitriolic critic of law enforcement and the FBI in particular.
Yes, and a Fox News commentator, and has been out there. She wrote a book in 2014 called License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. So she's a conspiracy theorist of some sort. And, you know, she's talked about the Mueller investigation being a complete setup to impugn the president and make it as hard as possible for the president to carry out his duties.
And she uses colorful phraseology on television. There's this phrase that people know about called mission creep, where you get assigned something and, you know, you expand beyond that. People said that about Ken Starr. Some critics of Mueller have said that about him. She turned the phrase on itself and said, well, actually, they're more like creeps on a mission.
It's hard not to laugh
so
at that.
That's very clever.
Yes.
It's very clever rhetoric on her
She's
part.
Not a fan of Robert Mueller and his
So now it looks like, even though this is the thing that seemed to have gotten Michael Flynn in trouble with the judge, because he wasn't having any of it, compared to what Sidney Powell likes to say, a fairly mild sentencing submission in which the Mueller team was criticized and in which Michael Flynn was made out to be the victim and, you know, poor, sorry, pathetic Michael Flynn, who's only, you know, a general for a long time and the national security advisor, that he was set up and victimized by all of this.
The judge was having none of that.
None of that. And now to double down on that strategy by firing those lawyers as, you know, perhaps too weak on this point, and hiring a bomb thrower who calls people on the Mueller team creeps on a mission, and has said in other circumstances, you know, the entire investigation was a setup and none of this is a crime. And, you know, my client, I assume she's going to say, as the prior lawyers made it seem like they were about to say, was a victim, that they're on a course to withdraw the guilty plea, which I don't think will succeed, because I think the judge is seeing a lot of nonsense happen. But it's an interesting strategy, not one I would pursue. What do you think?
And one interesting point is that she wrote an op-ed for the Daily Caller in February 2018 praising the fact that Flynn's case had gone to Judge Sullivan, and wrote, "Judge Sullivan is the perfect judge to decide General Flynn's motion. The judicial hero of my book, Emmett Sullivan, held federal prosecutors in contempt for failing to disclose evidence, dismissed the corrupted prosecution of Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, and appointed a special prosecutor to investigate the Department of Justice." So she's a huge fan of Judge Sullivan's. I remember listening to Judge Sullivan and during the Flynn sentencing hearing, and he essentially accused Flynn of betraying his country. I mean, he went so far beyond. Flynn's lawyers were saying he made a false statement, he did some things wrong, but they were really saying he's been so cooperative and helpful, he didn't do that much. And Sullivan was the exact opposite, was basically saying, like, this is a United States general who had this incredible opportunity, and he betrayed his country in the way he dealt with the Russians and all these other things. And so I think if that's the strategy, to go in and say the entire Mueller investigation was a setup, Flynn is innocent, please let him withdraw his plea, I think it's a terrible strategy to walk in on, particularly knowing what we know about where the judge has been on Flynn. The judge was a lot harder on Flynn than I think the government even expected. You're right. It was pretty softly written. Everyone was saying, don't give him jail. And then the judge was about to put him in jail. And that's why they continued.
That's what it looked like.
That's why they continued, in my view.
All right, next topic. We haven't really talked a lot about this person. I don't think
we've ever spoken about her.
Kellyanne Conway. She has a lot of roles. Her job title is counselor to the president, I believe. She was obviously a chief spokesperson for the president. And the principal thing that she appears to do is talk on behalf of the president on television.
And fight with her husband on Twitter.
Well, that,
know, I don't know if that's an official job.
They don't really fight on Twitter. He says a lot of things that are very interesting, and he's a smart person, and he's a really, really, really strong
anti-Trump
critic
Twitter.
Of the president. Mm-hmm. I retweet him often because he also does a good analysis of the various statutes and the Mueller report and everything else. I don't think he mentions his wife, but it's
you might be right.
It's an odd circumstance, and I don't know that he's commented on this. But there's this office, not to be confused with the special counsel's office, which no longer exists, that was run by Bob Mueller, but there's the United States Office of Special Counsel, OSC, which is an independent federal agency that basically is an ethics oversight watchdog entity that, among other things, monitors and tries to punish violations of something called the Hatch Act, which, by the way, the Hatch Act, for a long time I thought it was named after Orrin Hatch.
I did.
The senator from Utah,
okay,
who has been is no longer in the Senate, replaced by Mitt Romney. It is actually named after Senator Carl. Who knew there were two Hatches? Senator Carl Hatch of New Mexico back in 1939, which attempts to limit the political activities of federal employees. You and I have both been federal employees at various times, and there were lots and lots of things that we were not allowed to do. In essence, the Hatch Act restricts the political activity of individuals other than, there's one exemption, or two exemptions.
Two exemptions.
Other than the president and the vice president, employed or holding office in an executive agency, other than the Government Accountability Office. So if you're the president, the vice president, you can do or say whatever you want.
Because they have to run for re-election.
Yes.
And because they're part of the political apparatus of their party.
But if you're a counselor to the president or a chief of staff to the vice president or a United States attorney or an assistant U.S. attorney or, you know, anyone else.
Anyone who works in the federal government,
There are certain partisan political acts. Obviously, you have the right to vote and you have the right to give money.
And you have the right to campaign. You just can't use your
official title.
Exactly.
Yes. Right. The point is you can't use your official title, role, station, and all the power that that office brings
to support a political candidate.
Right. So if I went on my Twitter account when I was United States attorney and those things were monitored very, very carefully. Now I spout off because who cares? I'm a private citizen and I have this great podcast with you. But when I was in office, or when you were in office, if I started making endorsements or criticizing people in connection with an election, they would have shut down my Twitter account in about 4 seconds and I would have been accountable to the Office of Special Counsel in a very, very serious way.
Yes. It's worth noting, I remember when I first got to the Department of Justice, there was an entire presentation, a lecture on the Hatch Act. And basically, they scare you, right? And, you know, they basically make it clear. You can vote. You can even go out and go door-to-door canvassing for a political candidate, but you can never tell anyone that you work for the United States government. And you can't mix your business with your personal. So particularly where, for example, on Twitter, if you use your Twitter account for business purposes, you can't go out and start, you know, retweeting political campaign things. You're crossing a line. And so the idea is just to keep politics out of the federal government. And there's a good reason why. I mean, you can imagine, and this is how it started, that, you know, if you've got federal employees who are out campaigning for an elected official, it has the imprimatur of the government. And there's a lot of power and influence that goes with that. And so they keep it out. I had to sign something, and I bet Kellyanne Conway had to sign something too. I had to sign a document saying that I understood the restrictions of the Hatch Act.
It's not just because the official could then have an undue influence, but it also will result in the undermining of the credibility of that public official too. It's actually for the public official's own good.
Yes.
You know, there are similar restrictions, not in the Hatch Act. I also could not, for good reason, endorse a product and tell people, you know, buy Aquafina, you know, using my, I could tell people,
Did you just wear Aquafina t-shirts under your suit when you were doing press conferences? Subtle product placement?
Yeah, no, I did not do that. Yeah, because you're not supposed to use the official power of your office and title and influence of your office. It's another different, you know, situation. But for the same reason that if I got stopped by a cop, if I was speeding, it was a no-no to roll down the window. And before they asked me for my license and registration, explain to them that I was the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York.
I feel like this is a setup because you know I was stopped when I was AG.
Well, I didn't know you were going to tell this story, but I hoped you might.
I feel I've been set up, ladies and gentlemen.
So
of
wait
the
a minute.
Audience.
Were you speeding?
I was driving my, I think it was a 1993 Honda. This was in 2007, I think.
Good car.
And great car. We only got rid of it when my son was born because we were trying to understand how to put a car seat in, and someone said to us, you know that cars before 1996 don't even have modern safety restraints. Like, you cannot put a baby in this car. Yeah, I was running errands in the morning before work, and I had full-time state trooper protection, but I only used them for my official duties. I would never use them for my personal errands, so I was out in my car rushing to get back. I don't want to say I was caught in a speed trap, but, you know, I would just say it was a little bit.
Wow.
I was guilty.
The people who caught you in the quote-unquote speed trap are, in fact, your underlings.
Yes. So this is a great story.
You're their boss.
I'm their boss. So the AG in New Jersey is the chief. This is taking a turn I didn't expect, but I'm going to walk right into it and be transparent. The AG is the chief law enforcement officer and has authority over every police officer and prosecutor in the state. So an officer pulls me over. My immediate reaction is, I can't let him know who I am, right? That basically, like, I'm just going to take the ticket. So usually, you know, I talk to everyone, pretty social. I literally take my driver's license and registration out of my thing, and I just hand it to him. Like, I'm not even making eye contact. At the same time, he goes back to check my license. I immediately send a note to the troopers who were with me because they had my registration and license on alarm. So they would find out if anything happened to me first. They always want to make sure that, you know, what if I was in an accident? They would want to find out.
So if someone runs it, they know.
Exactly. So they would get pinged. So I basically send a note saying, I just got pulled over. I'm fine. Don't do anything, right? Not that I thought they would, but you have to be really careful. And the guy comes back and says, you were speeding. Here's your ticket. I say, thank you, officer. I appreciate it. I get in my car. I drive to work. And I basically say, I just got a speeding ticket. I'm going to pay it. By the way, we need to publicly announce it.
Well, that's amazing to me. And I tell the story about you to people when they want advice on how to be a leader and how to stay clear of trouble, that you proactively put out a release describing the incident.
Yes, because we oversaw them. First of all, I needed to take responsibility because I oversaw the police officers. And it was honestly the first time I'd ever been given a speeding ticket in my whole life. And I was very upset about it.
I know.
But I got a big one. I made up for it by doing it when I was AG. And so I put it out. And actually, my press guy, who I love, wrote, you know, I was stopped in my 1993 Honda, which led to a lot of very funny conversations about why I drove a 1993 Honda. And perhaps the funniest conversation came from Chris Christie, who has since said publicly, he'd been stopped, but he had never said anything publicly, said to me at one point, God, if I'd known how much good press you could get out of it, I would have just told people. But I did not do it to get good press. I did it because I was the head of the law enforcement community, and I had to be forthright about it. Now, here's the other funny story, which I've never told, which is that I said to our communications director, I said, please call the chief. I don't want to do it, but please make sure that he knows we're about to release a statement.
The chief of?
Of the chief of police, of the department where it happened. I just didn't want them to be surprised, you know, caught off guard. The chief swears to my communications director that I had not been stopped. He swears I would know about it. There's no way it happened. To the point where I had to give a copy of the ticket to the communications director to send it to the police chief, who then was deeply apologetic, which he shouldn't have been, because it was exactly the right thing that happened. Subsequently, there was an item on the test for the new police officers that they had to identify the name of who the state AG was, because clearly the guy had no idea who I was. But it's a great thing that he didn't know, and I would have insisted on the ticket. And so he made my life better. How do we get here from Kellyanne?
Well, no, because I'll tell you why, and not to overly praise my co-host, but your instinct not to use your official position and not to try to get away with something that any ordinary citizen would not be able to get away with is exactly the kind of instinct that I think makes you a good person and a good leader, and is exactly the kind of instinct that is utterly lacking in most members of the Trump inner circle, including his family, including members of his cabinet, even though some of them have $1 billion on the side anyway, think that office is for the perks, and they exploit the perks, and they're happy about the perks, and they boast about the perks. It's not about the perks. It's about the service. And, you know, if more people, I think, had this point of view, I think they would get in less trouble. So now, going back to Kellyanne Conway, we can talk about the particulars of what she's been accused of in terms of the violation of the Hatch Act. But the way I look at it, separate from those particulars, there's this defiant attitude on the part of Kellyanne Conway and others, and you can have disputes about each individual violation and whether or not it infringes on free speech or otherwise, but there's this attitude, which is very different from the one you just described, of entitlement, and the laws don't apply to me, and the rules are stupid, and why should we follow them? I mean, you could make the argument.
And that's in everything. It's not just in this. It's in the congressional subpoenas.
Yeah, it's in all things. And look, you could make the argument that it's silly. You know, you're the attorney general of the state, and it's important for you to be able to get to someplace on time, and it's absurd. You could make this argument, and it's absurd that you would be stopped and get a speeding ticket, and it's silly they work for you. I mean, I think that's what Donald Trump would say. But you don't make that argument. And if you think a rule is not good, or you think a law shouldn't be applied to you, then make an argument
change
for changing
the law.
Exactly. Change the law, as opposed to after the fact say, well, that's kind of stupid, and we're just going to do what we want to do. And it may look, there are some laws and rules that are maybe not perfectly calibrated and that are incorrect and maybe go too far. But that's not the issue I have. The issue I have is they seem not to care. They seem actually, I don't curse that often here. They seem not to give a shit at all about what the rules are and think that they should be able to do what they want to do, whether it's about taking foreign help in connection with an election, or being able to say political things on your basically official Twitter account, to any one of a number of other things. And that's the thing that makes people like you and me crazy and reasonable people upset.
I think it's even worse than that in some ways, if that's possible, because they think the rules and the laws don't apply to them, but they're quick to point out that they should apply to other people, or quick to try to hold people accountable when it suits their political purpose. Also, what message does it send to every federal employee? And there are hundreds of thousands of them across the United States. What does it send that people are fired for this on one violation? People are forwarded to the Merit Systems Protection Board and they adjudicate these violations. People are held accountable. People have been terminated for this before. And so this wasn't the first time this had happened. She had been warned. There were multiple instances on Twitter, in public interviews, and they haven't corrected it, and they've had repeated conversations. And so it is thinking that you're above the law and thinking that the law applies to everyone but you that is just, it is so deeply problematic. And one of the things I found really fascinating by the report that went out, they basically say, we've never had to do this with someone who works in the White House. Essentially, they've never gone to the White House, presidents of both parties, and said, there's a problem with one of your employees violating the Hatch Act, and not had it immediately corrected or resolved.
Here's what the Office of Special Counsel that monitors the Hatch Act said about Kellyanne Conway. You know, the report goes on for a number of pages, but I'd love to sort of do the quick summary. Quote, beginning in February 2019, Ms. Conway, during official media appearances, engaged in a pattern of partisan attacks on several Democratic Party candidates shortly after they announced their candidacy for president, including Senator Cory Booker, Senator Elizabeth Warren, former Congressman Robert Francis Beto O'Rourke, and former Vice President Joe Biden. For example, in one interview, Ms. Conway insinuated that Senator Booker was sexist and a tinny motivational speaker. In another, Ms. Conway said Senator Warren was lying about her ethnicity and appropriating somebody else's heritage, and then goes on and on about things that she said in media interviews, and also on her Twitter account that they determined, the office determined, she uses to execute her official duties. All sorts of, you know, partisan political statements.
She's involved in the campaign. I mean, she's getting involved in the campaign on Trump's behalf.
There's a lengthy response from the White House pointing out a lot of things, including their allegation that the proper procedures weren't followed and there was not an opportunity to respond and rebut some of the allegations. Look, some of the points, we were discussing this before. You know, I try to look at these things with an open mind, and I do think there's a flagrant abuse of power going on in lots of places, and I think Kellyanne Conway has proven herself to be someone who doesn't tell the truth and who carries water in a way that does not reflect well on her and her veracity. And I think, you know, she was defiant in not trying to figure out a way to properly serve the president in the appropriate role and also be mindful of the Hatch Act.
She doesn't even respond when they
respond. Look, and one of the things that the response from the White House makes clear, and you can have two minds about this, it looks like the head of the OSC was personally offended by the way that Kellyanne Conway reacted before. I mean, Kellyanne, I think in the beginning of the report, it recites how Kellyanne mocked the authority of the OSC by saying, I mean, it's literally at the top of the executive summary of the report put out by the Office of Special Counsel, where they say Ms. Kellyanne Conway, counselor to the president, reportedly scoffed at her responsibilities under the Hatch Act and ridiculed its enforcement by asserting, quote, let me know when the jail sentence starts, close quote. It is clearly the case that part of the reason that Kellyanne Conway got put in the dock for this is that there was this sort of obnoxious scoffing at rules, which I understand and appreciate. And it's something that I think makes people like us annoyed, irritated, upset. But did the Office of Special Counsel make a mistake in making it so much about personal offense?
Well, I mean, sometimes we have to try to disentangle all these pieces because it's very clear that they've been having these conversations with her and with White House counsel in 2018 and now again since February of this year, 2019. And so it's not one thing. It's repeated. And it's clear that there are formal, at least two formal complaints that have been made. And so they're frustrated and that frustration is understandable, but that's whether or not you're frustrated doesn't make it a violation of the law. But what I see when I look at this is that she's clearly involved in the campaign. She's clearly trying to wear two hats, both the political campaign hat and the White House counselor hat. And my view is that the Hatch Act prohibits that. And so I think they're well within their rights to basically say, look, you're violating this. This has to stop. Now, she scoffs at it. She doesn't even respond to their letters. And the president says, I'm not going to fire her for that. She's terrific. And so one of the things I think we all have to be asking ourselves as we go into 2020 is, you know, there are people in the Department of Justice, there are people in other federal agencies who are being held accountable under this law and under these rules. And they're basically saying, like you said, we're above the law. And is that the kind of government that you want? And it's not corruption, capital C, where you're stealing money, but it is corruption, lowercase c, where, you know, you think you get to do what you want because you won the election to be the president of the United States. And then the question is, where's the line? And so—
Yeah, because not everyone, look, when you get elected president and you have a staff, obviously there's a political aspect to that. And obviously there's going to be some room and there's going to be some blurring. You know, that's just sort of inevitable. And particularly for somebody who's not a U.S. attorney, whose whole job is supposed to be apolitical, but somebody who's a counselor to the president, whose basic skill is communication and, you know, communication with lots of barbs and lots of invective and, you know, clever rhetoric. You know, I get all that. But there is, for good reason, a separation between politics and governance. And when you get elected president and you have a staff, they serve all Americans, not just a particular party. And so, you know, you and I both worked in the Senate. There are lots and lots of rules, not just the Hatch Act, that ensure a wall between politics and governance. So I was chief counsel to a senator. You were chief counsel to a senator. I never once was able to or involved in or had the authority to do anything with respect to a campaign on the part of a senator. Senators are not allowed to have campaign calls from their Senate office, from their official taxpayer-funded Senate office building. When Senator Schumer had to raise money in connection with his own reelection campaign or for the DSCC, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, he had to get in a car and drive to another office that was paid for by the committee.
Yeah, that's a great point.
To make those calls. I was not allowed, you know, if anybody ever mentioned to me, I remember this, you know, being advised about this, if any lobbyist or anyone else who was advocating for position ever mentioned to me that they, and it's happened once, ever mentioned to me that they were a friend of the senator, by which they meant
a contributor
yep. to the senator. Yep. That's the last time I spoke to that person.
Yep.
I never spoke to that person again. And I would advise other people not to speak to that person because I know people may not believe it and people are very cynical and maybe people, you know, are not as careful about this in being stopped by the police or in talking to lobbyists like I was. But that is the way it is supposed to work. And when you have people like Kellyanne Conway and others thumbing their nose at it, then I think you have a problem. And as you said, there should be an accommodation that should be reached. And when complaints are being made, Kellyanne should have been able to say, and lawyers should have been able to say, assuming that the Office of Special Counsel folks are reasonable, it's like, look, you either have to split your role or you have to find other venues where it's appropriate yep. to talk about these things. And I understand, like one of the points that the White House makes that's not ill-considered fully is that some of the occasions where the special counsel is saying that Kellyanne Conway breached the Hatch Act were times when she was on television and she did not volunteer some view about Cory Booker, but she was asked about a candidate and, you know, one could argue that a natural reaction for someone who's a counselor to the president is to respond in kind. The better answer, if you're being careful about the Hatch Act, is to say, you know what?
I can't talk about the
election.
That's
politics. Yeah. I'm not here to talk about politics. I'm here to talk about the president's policies. And they also make an interesting point that, you know, you got to be careful about a distinction between a pure campaign partisan statement and a policy statement and disagreement with people who are in office. You know, Cory Booker is a sitting United States senator. It should be appropriate for people who work on the White House staff to criticize someone from the other party on an issue of policy or something else. Kellyanne Conway probably could have succeeded in fulfilling her duty to the president and promoting the president's agenda in a way that didn't have to be so blatantly violative of the Hatch Act.
Yes, there is a legitimate argument to be made that, you know, she can be critical of the people who are in government who are running for president on policy questions. But when you look at her tweets, there's no question that it's a political thing. And she's also forwarded campaign tweets. And so that crosses the line.
Yeah, and it's not like the president is powerless to respond. First, he can respond. The vice president can respond. And then
he has a whole army of people.
And he has the head of the RNC. And there are many, many, many people.
Surrogates outside of government.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Look, there's a reason why the president cannot. There was a whole scandal about raising money from the Lincoln bedroom. Not raising money. What was it again?
Selling the Lincoln bedroom. Selling all the high donors got to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom.
Yeah, there's, you know, you cannot have a fundraiser in the White House, right? There's a reason for that. That's not the same as a Hatch Act violation, but there are reasons for these rules. They're important that they be respected and followed.
One other note on the White House's response, which, by the way, is very well written. And so they've clearly said, look, we're going to have a fight with you because we don't want to listen to any of this stuff. They talk about the First Amendment, and it has always been clear that, you know, people have the right to speak out and to free speech in the United States. And what the Hatch Act has always tried to do is basically say, when you're with the government, you're with the government. if you want to do it personally on your own private time and in no way using your connection to the government, letting anybody know that you're with the government, but yes, you can make a political donation. You could go show up at someone's house and say, I think you should vote for so-and-so. So they're raising an issue that I think is a longstanding issue. That's a reasonable conversation to have. But again, I think that the law is, the Hatch Act comes down in the right place. The thing that I really found problematic about the White House's response is that one of their first arguments is that the Office of Special Counsel has failed to follow the appropriate procedures required under the law. What is unbelievable about that is that there have now been more than 35 federal cases in which this administration has been found to have violated the Administrative Procedures Act. And what that means is that when there are laws and there are ways that policies, and I'm not even sure it applies here to the Hatch Act in truth, but there is an entire regulatory system in the United States where when you're passing an agency, think about the Environmental Protection Agency, they're passing environmental regulations. There's a legal process that they must follow and go through in order to pass those regulations, which allow for public comment, dialogue, and there's a process that has to be followed. The people who have followed it the least of any administration is the current president of the United States. And for them to make as one of their prime arguments, which is like, look, you're not following the right way that the policies and procedures are supposed to be followed, is just another example to me that they choose when and what laws to abide by when it suits them. They are quick to walk into court and say, look, other people should be following these. When it doesn't suit them, they just blow right by them.
That's a great segue to another controversy and fight and battle that's been going on and we've talked about on the show before. And that is a particular request for the president's tax returns by the House Ways and Means Committee. And we talked about this before. We talked about Chairman Neal's letter to the Treasury Department asking for the tax returns. Well, this past week, after Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, made clear that he would refuse to turn over the tax returns, he now has the benefit of an opinion, a written opinion, by the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department defending his refusal. Remember, the Office of Legal Counsel we've talked about many, many, many times. They're supposed to be semi-autonomous and independent within the Department of Justice. They make legal conclusions and interpret the Constitution for the federal government, and particularly the Department of Justice. They're the ones who brought you the two memos on whether or not the president could be indicted, a sitting president, saying they could not be. So what do you make of all this?
I think it's a lot of woof and quack to
me. It's a lot of what?
Woof and quack.
I don't even know.
I was going to make the noises, but like, no, it's a lot of nonsense.
I've never heard. Did you make up that phrase?
No, I did not make up that phrase. It's a lot of nonsense. It's a lot of like.
I'm 50 years old. I've been in America for 49 years.
Have.
I haven't heard a woof and quack.
Oh, it may be from a children's book. I'm not sure.
Well,
but look, I
think we should use it much more often.
Let's bring it back if it was ever popular. The statute says that the Treasury Department shall provide the information.
Shall.
And what does shall mean, Preet? This is day one of law school.
Shall means must.
And that means...
And it doesn't, in the statute itself, doesn't say that you have to provide a reason, right? And the opinion actually makes that clear. So it's kind of interesting, right? The opinion that backs Steve Mnuchin's refusal says, we advise that although the text of the section does not require the committee to state any purpose for its request, Congress could not constitutionally confer upon itself the right to compel disclosure by the executive branch that does not serve a legitimate legislative purpose. And then they, as we'll talk about, they make the argument that the reason for the request is not the real reason, that it's a pretext.
Right. And they decide that because it's a pretext, they have the ability to not comply with the statute, which says shall provide the information. And my overall takeaway is that the Office of Legal Counsel, I don't want to say it's never been politicized because I know it has been. This felt incredibly political to me, and it made me sad for the Department of Justice and all the good men and women that work there. As you and I both know, it's essentially rubber stamping this decision not to follow the law, basically. They don't go to court. You know, this is their internal support.
Yeah.
Instead of having gone to court up front and basically said, we think it's a pretext, they do this opinion by the Department of Treasury. They do this opinion by the Office of Legal Counsel, all sort of putting all these bells and whistles around the fact that the bottom line is they're just not complying with the law. And they've made a decision. We don't like it. We don't like that you're asking for this. And so we don't want to comply with it. And that's just not the way that the law can work. And by the way, again, you can think the law is wrong. You can think that Congress shouldn't get access to any individual's tax returns without making a showing of good cause, but the law doesn't require that showing.
Yep. In fairness to the administration's point of view, you and I discussed Chairman Neal's letter asking for the tax returns, which stated, you know, this sort of random you know, purpose for wanting them that we criticized, that it was not expansive. It seemed, pretextual is a loaded term, but it seemed not the thing that was really...
it was a little too cute.
Was. Yeah, and there were good reasons either to say nothing and say, we just want this because the statute does not require, as everyone seems to acknowledge, the statute does not require a purpose need to be given, or they could have laid out all sorts of reasons, and there are many, many, many legitimate reasons, both that relate to oversight and to legislative function for asking for the tax returns. Now, the Office of Legal Counsel acknowledges that in various circumstances, in various places, members of Congress have stated other purposes for getting the tax returns, and they lay them all out in a footnote in the opinion, in footnote 19. And what some people have observed, including Professor Marty Lederman, who's a smart guy, who says what's really extraordinary about the opinion is not the fact that they're alleging there's a pretext, but that they're saying all these bases to get the tax returns, including to discover and expose Trump's potential conflicts, including to protect against violations of the Emoluments Clause and conflicts of interest, including to make sure that the president and his family are not hiding financial ties that could cause conflict, you know, all sorts of reasons. The administration is now saying none of those are legitimate. And as Marty Lederman points out in a Twitter thread that I thought was right on point, in this respect, the OLC opinion is of a piece with Trump's brief in Mazars. That's the case where the Oversight Committee has been asking for financial information from Trump's accountants, and that's being dealt with in the courts in the D.C. Circuit right now. Marty Lederman says it's a fundamental attack on the power of Congress to investigate and expose to itself and the public whether and how the POTUS's duty of undivided loyalty to the public interest may be compromised. And Marty agrees with us that OLC is basically correct, that the IRS oversight justification, quote, even if it's not pretextual, it's certainly not what's driving the train either. This is part of a pattern of this administration, no matter what the department is, saying Congress really has no role in investigating anything having to do with the president, notwithstanding the history that says otherwise.
There's no oversight is basically what they're saying, is that you don't get to oversee the actions of the executive branch, which is completely contrary to a document known as the United States Constitution.
We talk about the concept of hypocrisy all the time. Lots of people have also been pointing out in different contexts how rich it is that this administration is saying, well, we don't have to comply with this request because even though the statute doesn't require a rationale to be given, the fact that you have given us a bogus rationale that we think is pretextual is a basis for refusing altogether. So go to hell, right? In other contexts, this administration is taking the position that pretext doesn't matter at all. And we've talked about the census question and this, I think, developing scandal about how the reason proffered by the administration as to why they wanted to add a citizenship question to the census about policing voting rights is actually full on a pretext, because we have information from a Republican operative who's now deceased saying that the reason they wanted to do this question was to suppress participation in the census. That would absolutely help Republicans in a partisan way. So, you know, this pretext issue, it cuts both ways.
Do you call it hypocrisy when it's in the legal context? What would
I call it that, or I call it a woof and quack? No, it's the opposite of woof and quack. Woof and quack means there's nothing there.
Right. Well, woof and quack means a lot of nonsense. If your child is arguing with you and they're making up all these, you know, I don't want to go to sleep, I need water, and I need to go to the bathroom, that's a lot of woof and quack.
That's a lot.
Hypothetically.
Of woof and quack. You're not implicating any particular child.
I'm not
child.
Implicating anyone in that.
Right. So we covered a lot of ground, including your speeding ticket.
Yeah. Thanks.
Which was my favorite story of the morning.
Didn't see that one coming.
All right, send us your questions, folks. We'll do our best to answer them.
Take care. See you soon.
This is the Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Aaron Dalton. And the Cafe team is Carla Pierini, Julia Doyle, Calvin Lord, Vinay Basti, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.